all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, topics today. The stock market bubble going on right now in the U.S., the Italian referendum vote of last week and what it means for Italian and European banking system. And we want to talk about some repercussions here that are coming from the continued rise in U.S. Rates, interest rates, and the dollar, i.e. the Trump trade, as they call it, what's going on, the implications of all that. We want to talk about what it looks like it may portend for China. China bank loans, non-performing loans, and capital flight, and currency devaluation. And then, of course, what that means for emerging markets, which are the tail end of all this. Okay, let's start by talking about the U.S. stock market bubble, because now it is clearly in bubble territory here. If you've been watching it since the Trump election, huge increases in all the four major U.S. stock markets. That's the Dow market, the NASDAQ market, the S&P 500, and the Russell market. Okay, all are going through the roof. So far, the Dow, let's focus on the Dow. All right, a 300% increase since 2009, 300%. It was at 6,500, now it's, I don't know, it's going up every day. It's well over 19,600. Probably by next week, it will be well over 20,000 on the Dow. That's more than three times what it was. Three times. All four markets that I mentioned are going through the roof. They are all at record levels. What's driving this stock market bubble, and what does it portend? Okay, several things. First of all, anticipation by capitalists, corporations, and investors that there's big tax cuts coming. Big tax cuts, probably bigger than under George W. Bush. We'll talk about those numbers shortly here. By the way, Bush tax cuts continued nicely under Obama and even increased under Obama, so they're going to increase again. We got an acceleration of tax cuts for the corporations and investors. Under George Bush, it was $3.4 trillion between 2001 and 2004 alone. That's not counting the boondoggle that was passed in 2005, allowing multinational corporations to bring back, repatriate their offshore profits they were refusing to pay. Boondoggle was created in 2005, allowed them to bring back, instead of paying 35% corporate tax rate, they paid 5.25%. Well, you know, it was about just under $1 trillion at that time being hoarded offshore. And they brought back about $700 billion, I guess. And they only paid 5.25%. Well, we have that boondoggle, too, going on here. We'll talk about that shortly. But, you know, the Bush tax cuts, $3.4 trillion, 80% of which went to investors and corporations. And not counting the repatriation. And that's just, you know, from 2001 to 2005. Okay. Big corporate tax cuts coming now, further under Trump and his Republican Congress got it locked up. And it's probably going to be estimates between 4.3 to 6.2 trillion, depending what source. The Trump team says 4.3 trillion, but the Tax Policy Center says it's 6.2 trillion. Okay, so on top of George W. Bush's $3.4 trillion, and on top of Obama's $6 trillion. Yes, $6 trillion under Obama, almost twice as much as under Bush. Obama continues the Bush tax cuts for 2 years in 2009 and 10, cost $450 billion. his recovery tax, his 2009 fiscal stimulus tax bill, provided at least $300 billion. Then he, in 2010, when the economy wasn't going, he passed another $800 billion, half of which was extension of Bush tax cuts, plus more. And then with the infamous fiscal cliff nonsense that was perpetrated on the public, he passed in January 2013 another $5 trillion. In other words, continued the Bush tax cuts for another decade, costing $5 trillion more. So, you know, over $9 trillion in tax cuts under Bush and Obama. And now we're going to add another $4 to $6 trillion, as if the greedy SOBs don't have enough. They want more, more, more. And they always want more, you know. I've been in a lot of labor negotiations, and it doesn't matter. You make concessions, they just want more. If you keep giving, they keep taking. And taking more and more. That's the way these people think. You know, that's the way they negotiate. You know, whether it's in a labor contract negotiation or whether it's at the top level of political negotiation. And they just want more. Because they know they can get it. As long as people keep backing up, they will get it. Okay. So big corporate tax cuts coming, that has stimulated businesses. Expectations of more profits in the future, and that's what's feeding the stock market bubble in part, because there's more to the story. In other words, they anticipate having a lot more extra cash, and a lot of that investment is going now into the stock market in anticipation. Even though they don't have the tax cuts yet, they're anticipating it because they're sitting on huge cash hoards already, you see. Let's just commit those cash hoards we have now to stock purchases. You know, I'm talking primarily about the bank shadow banks, big corporations, big-time investors, and anticipation of more to come. Well, that's partly was driving stocks, you know, corporate institutional investors buying these stocks in anticipation of having a lot more money in the future and anticipating infrastructure spending coming as well. And that would generate profits of corporations and drive up their stock prices. Well, it's buy now because the stock prices are going to be driven up. Well, what industries will infrastructure spending drive? Well, obviously, construction industry, materials and commodities, mining, etc., the transport industry, trucking, railroads, etc., energy, and banks to finance it. I anticipate that probably this infrastructure spending bill will be about $500 billion over 10 years. Okay. Not going to have a real big effect on the economy, however, because it will be capital intensive, won't generate a lot of jobs. But it will generate GDP, and it will generate profits. So we will have a somewhat reversal of the capital spending crash that's been going on for almost a decade now. You know, capital spending in this country was down to 0.1% last quarter. Nothing. Usually it's 10%. Of GDP. Well, it's down to 0.1% flat. Doesn't exist. All right, so now everyone's excited here on the corporate side because now we'll get some capital spending, which will boost GDP a little bit, you know. Won't boost jobs, but, you know, it will boost the stocks of these construction and mining and materials and commodities and transport and energy and bank companies. And if you look at where the stock bubble is concentrated, it's exactly in these companies. Right now. Also, what Trump means is that ACA, the Affordable Care Act, is going to be defanged, and health insurance companies and hospital chains and so forth and Big Pharma are now going to be released from any pressure that was holding down already rising healthcare premium insurances and drug costs and, you know, healthcare costs in general. Now, you know, it's going to be open season here and watch these prices go even more than they have been. Okay, so the stocks of those companies are doing great too. Insurance companies, healthcare companies, pharma, you know. So that's part of the stock boom. Infrastructure companies are part of the stock boom. Anticipation of corporate investment, corporate tax cuts as part of the boom. Defense spending companies, right? I mean, come on, you got how many generals we got appointed now in this cabinet? You know, this is an administration of billionaires and generals. That's what we got. So defense spending companies anticipate more. Oil and energy, of course, anticipate more. Why? Because the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, is going to be pretty much put on ice. So they anticipate more opportunity. And, of course, banks, because they expect whatever there was in that bill called Dodd-Frank, banking deregulation, that's going away too. So, you know, anticipation of stock tax cuts and infrastructure spending and deregulation of these various industries are fueling across the board almost a stock boom. And they're driving it to bubble levels at all levels, you know, whether it's the Dow or S&P 500 or whatever. Now, that's not the whole picture, though. You know, another major force that's driving the stock is the unwinding of the bond bubble that we recently had here. Bond prices driven by the central bank to record lows in interest rates. You know, the Federal Reserve pumping all this money, zero interest, near zero interest, into the banks and the shadow banks and them loaning it to other investors and themselves and both investing in stocks drove the stock market up as high as it could to about 18,000, the Dow, 17,500, 18,000, where it got stuck over the last year or so because they got as much mileage as they could out of the free money in terms of financing, speculative investing in stocks, bonds, so on and so forth. It was clear that monetary policy, Federal Reserve, money injection, liquidity injection in the system boosted from 2009 up to about 2015 all these financial asset markets to record levels. But then it began churning. It couldn't get any higher, you see, with just the free money. And that was clear after a year. And that's why capitalist central bankers around the world and policymakers realize that they've squeezed monetary policy for all they can get. And now it's time to shift to another strategy to generate even more profits for the 1% in their corporations. And that's why even before the election, even before Trump came, the winds were already shifting towards more infrastructure spending, more fiscal spending, meaning big tax cuts and government-focused subsidies for certain private industries and companies to expand infrastructure. That was already happening. That was already coming. I mean, even Hillary was talking about this. You know, her proposal for a infrastructure spending was $250 billion over 10 years. Okay. What is that, $25 billion a year? Yeah, that was token. But, you know, it was significant change in thinking about how the capitalist would generate their profits in the future. Trump had talked about $10 trillion. Well, of course, that's not going to happen because $10 trillion would just total bust the budget deficit, and Congress will pare that down. I expect about half in infrastructure spending, about $5 trillion, over the course of 10 years. Okay. Maybe not even that much. I think you're going to get maybe $100 billion a year, okay? More like a trillion out of this Congress. Because this is a Republican Congress, And they're looking at their at the deficits and the debt at the same time, and they can only squeeze so much out of the people on social spending. We'll talk more about the numbers shortly. But the bond bubble is unwinding. Well, what does that mean? That means money is moving out of bonds, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere around the world, too, vast economies. Excuse me. In particular, Europe, and the money is flowing into the stock market, you see. It's a rotation going on, a big one, and it's rapid. It's happening very fast. Well, why is money going out of bonds? Because bond interest rates are rising. The Fed now is, you know, acknowledging they got all they can out of monetary policy, and they're going to start tapering off. And interest rates are going to rise next week. We'll talk about it in the show next week, but definitely take it to the bank, pun. You know, rates are going to rise. Short-term rates by the Federal Reserve. The Fed doesn't control long-term rates. Those are controlled by general economic conditions. But short-term rates tend to boost long-term rates with a lag, and that's going to happen. The Fed's going to raise rates next week. And that's going to boost long-term rates, already rising rapidly as this bubble unwinding occurs. You know, just in a matter of a few weeks here, we've had about a 1% hike in government bond rates. You know, both the 10-year and the 30-year bond have up by almost 1%. I mean, in such a short time, that's amazing. That's a bubble unwinding there. And when bond rates go up, bond prices collapse. And that's happening too. Well, who wants to hold bonds when the price and value, therefore, of those bonds are collapsing? No, people get out of it. They sell those bonds. And where are you going to put that money? If you're a rich professional investor, you've got to put it somewhere. Well, maybe if you're cautious, you'll put in mutual funds as a holding pattern. But, you know, if you're looking at the tea leaves here about infrastructure spending and corporate tax cuts coming, and a Congress that's almost assuredly going to do that, well, then you move your money into the stock market. And that's exactly what they're doing. Or you start speculating more on foreign exchange currencies. Because this rise in interest rates is driving up the dollar. The long-term rise in rates is already driving up the dollar. And as the dollar goes up, these other currencies go down. So speculate. Speculate on the rise of the dollar. Speculate on the collapse of other currencies, particularly currencies in emerging markets. Those are really in free fall. We'll talk about that some more. But, you know, Mexican peso, Turkish lira, Argentine peso, etc., around the world, collapsing. Well, you know, that's a good speculative play. You buy now and you make a capital gain when it collapses on the way down, or if it rises on the way up, like the dollar, you make a capital gain on it. So a lot of that money is coming out of bonds, going into stock markets, particularly in the U.S., where already the U.S. is leading on infrastructure and fiscal spending return. Just as it led, by the way, on the monetary shift by the central bank in 2009-10, right now, the U.S. is leading on the infrastructure shift, tax cut shift, leading the rest of the world, which will follow. And that's how the money's going to be made now going forward in the next phase. Bubble unwinding. Well, why is bubble unwinding having an effect globally? Right? Well, for this reason. Investors are global, and investors look at relative bond rates, what they call the spread. And if the bond rates on the U.S. bonds, both government and corporate, are rising faster than bond rates in Europe, well, what do you think European professional investors are going to do? The bond prices are falling because their rates are rising. You got a better deal investing in rates in the U.S., the spread of 2% or more over German rates, more even so over Italian and other European bonds. So take your money out of that, dump those, and move it to the U.S. move it into U.S. stocks, or move it, you know, if you want a safer portfolio, move it into higher interest rate U.S. bonds, government bonds. So the money is slushing around globally, and it's coming back to the U.S., and it's flowing out of bonds and fixed investment into stock markets, and that's having a big effect on the stock bubble here in the U.S. So it's not just tax cuts. It's not just anticipating infrastructure spending. It's not just looking at the deregulation going on in certain sectors. It's also this unwinding of the global bond bubble and the devaluing of currencies globally. As the dollar rises, these other currencies decline. Well, who wants to hold these other currencies if you're a professional investor, right? No, you're not going to hold collapsing Mexican pesos or collapsing Turkish lira. You're just taking the loss holding that paper. So you're going to dump that. Dump that and what? Move your money into a currency that's rising. Ah, the dollar. Which means you've got to sell those currencies and buy dollars, and the dollars come back to the U.S. So we have this flow of liquidity, financial liquidity, coming not only out of Europe, but coming out of emerging markets, coming to the U.S. It's got to go somewhere. You know, you can't all sit in mutual funds. A lot of it goes into the stock market because that's where the short-term opportunity is right now. And we're going to see a rise in corporate profits, which are already shot up 5% in the third quarter, and it's going to go further. Okay, so that's what's really driving the stock bubble, all those forces converging. And the capitalists are, you know, just rubbing their hands saying, ooh, big profits coming now. Whoa, you know, we don't care if it's monetary base. You know, the Federal Reserve gave us freebies here, trillions of dollars of freebies. And as I said before, you know, over $5 trillion, maybe $6 trillion in bonds, corporate bonds, were issued since 2009. And $5 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. See, this is how it works. The big profits are in financial assets. So you engineer the monetary system in order to generate financial asset price inflation. You know, the stock market tripled. Dow tripled. That's inflation. You know, not inflation in goods and services, but inflation in financial assets. That's all capital gains, you see. So you engineer it so, you know, these financial asset markets boom since 2009. And then you cut taxes so that the realization of capital gains and dividends and so forth gets passed through in a larger magnitude than ever before. And that's why you get 97% of all national income gains since 2009 going to the wealthiest 1% households, all of whom are investors, you see. That's how you get 97% of all the income gains going to the 1%, which is an acceleration over the 65% going to the one wealthiest 1% under George W. Bush years, which is an acceleration over the 48% during the Clinton years. So we have an acceleration of income inequality going on, a rapid acceleration. Well, what's the source of that? The source of that is subsidizing financial markets through monetary policies. That's what the Fed did. It bailed out the banks and it kept the largesse going for 8 years, almost 7 years, of free money that just pumped up these markets. The problem is if you pump up these financial markets, you know, the gains are so lucrative and attractive that you don't get investment in real things. Because after all, you know, if I got to loan money to mom and pop business, you know, maybe they'll fail. Or even a larger company, you know, they got to make sure they get raw materials and resources. They got to line up suppliers. They hire workers. You don't know if they're going to, you know, have problems with wages and so forth. gee, that's not a very good risk for me, a professional investor. You know, I'm going to put my money in these financial markets. I can go in and out real quick, capital gains. Hey. And that's what's happened to 21st century capitalism, you see. It's become globalized and financialized, and it's far more profitable to invest in financial asset markets. That was the main theme of my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, published earlier this year. I talk about this. And it's really the cause of the lion's share of the income inequality I just talked about. Yes, you know, corporations get a bigger share by holding down wages, which is what they've done too. That's boosted profits. But large corporations, a third of all their profits are from portfolio investment, financial asset investing, you see. So both go on now. Capitalists in the last couple decades have learned how to expand and accelerate their profits through financial speculation as well as through cost reduction, i.e. squeezing wages, which they've also done very well, you see. They have the best of both worlds now. So when you listen to liberals talk about, oh, we got to raise the minimum wage, you know, that's important. Well, of course it's important, but that's not the main cause of all the income inequality. Yeah, we have a problem here of lack of growth of wage incomes, and I'll talk about that shortly, over the last several decades, especially under Obama. That's a problem that contributes to income inequality. But the big, big cause of the income inequality is all this capital gains stuff going on, enabled by the monetary system, enabled by the central bank, right? And enabled by the tax cuts that allow these capital gains to be passed through to investors and shareholders in far greater magnitudes than ever before. You see, the tax system is an enabler. It's not the cause of this, but it allows corporations and investors to keep far more than they might have otherwise. Okay. Now, we've been talking about what is really the big shift here from monetary policy, free Fed money that pumped up the stock, bond, and other markets, to what is now a shift of the fiscal means to pumping up profits. And they're going to pass through even more tax cuts to allow even more to be realized, you see. And we've had this money flowing back globally into the U.S. from Europe and emerging markets. A great rotation from bonds to stocks, from foreign currencies and markets to U.S. currencies and markets. This is what's going on. It's a change. It's a shift. It's a big shift, but it's a continuation by other means of how to keep expanding corporate and investor profits. That's what it's all about. It's the same thing. It's just a different policy focus and mix. Okay. Now, you know, you can look at this and you read the press and, oh, things are going to be so good now, you know, the stock market's up and so forth, you know. But there are other economic data and indicators that are more important or just as important on the other side of the ledger. What are they? What's going on now in terms of other indicators? Well, coincidentally, and interestingly, a new report came out by the Saez Piketty group here. You know, Emmanuel Saez, who's pioneered a lot of this income inequality stuff, looking since 2002, by the way, which I talked about in 2005 in my book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush, before liberals, you know, like Reich and Krugman and Stiglitz all discovered income inequality about 10 years later, around 2012. Anyway, Sayers, Piketty, Sayers in particular, Emmanuel Sayers, professor at UC Berkeley in economics, has created this world income and wealth database. Go check it out. And he's just come out with his latest update to this. By the way, it's all based on IRS data, you know, which up until Sayers, the government conveniently ignored reporting, you see. They kept the Commerce Department, you know, which is the pro-business cabinet in the U.S. government, and even the Labor Department and the Federal Reserve and, you know, Congressional Budget Office, and all of them came out with their income shares trends, you know. But they always looked at 20% and fifths, right? 20% of the households, you know, what did they get? Top 20, bottom 20, and ignored the fact that it was all being concentrated not in the top 20, but in the top 1%, or even 1/10 of 1, or 1/100th of 1% households. You know, it's about 130 million taxpaying households in this country. Well, Sayers comes along and he says, oh, well, let's fine cut this. Let's look at this in some more detail here. Let's look at the IRS data. And since 2002, he's been releasing these reports, which are very revealing. And he just released the latest here. So what was it? What did the latest say? Well, the latest said that the average income, right, of the bottom 50% households, 60 million plus households, adjusted for inflation, is the same today as it was 1980. Well, today, 2014 is the latest data. So it's gotten worse. But anyway, 2014 is what his release is about, right? There's been zero growth in real wages since 1980 for the bottom 50%, bottom half of households, right? And workers under 30 years old, right, back in 1970s, 92% of them were making more than their parents. 30-year-old millennials, right? 30-year-old and under, you know. 92% of them were making more than their parents. Today, you know what it is? It's less than half. And for male, I think it's less than 40%, just about 40%. 30-year-olds, 40% of them, only 40% are making more than their parents. In other words, 60%, two-thirds roughly, almost, of 30-year-old males, millennials, are making less than what their parents were making in real wage adjusted. Less. Talk about income immobility. Right? You would need an annual for a decade of a 6% wage hike for all these people, for 60 million people, a 6% wage hike every year for a decade just to get back to the 1970s, right? Now, when we say income here in the Sayers data, it's not just wages. You know, some people, critics, you know, on the right, conservatives, pro-business economists say, well, that's just wages, you know. What about transfer payments? You know, what about fringe benefits? What about food stamps? You know, these are all things that are part of income, too. And when you look at that, you know, people are actually doing better. Well, the Sayers data accounted for transfer payments, you know, unemployment insurance and so forth, accounted for fringe benefits, accounted for food stamps. And still, 60% of young male, millennial males are making less than their parents at that age, right? Very interesting, isn't it? Another way of looking at it, according to the Sayers data, is the bottom 50% households in 1980 had 19.9% of national income. Today, well, 2014, 12.5%. Conversely, the top wealthiest 1% households had 10.7% in 1980, and today, 2014, had increased that to 20.2%. So in other words, the it's being shifted from the bottom to the top 1%, from the bottom 50 to the top 1%. That's the shift going on. Okay. What's the bottom 50? Roughly people who are making 48,000 thereabouts a year or less. Now, you should also keep in mind that when we say 19% in 1980, was 19.9 was going to the bottom 50 and 10.7 to the top 1 of national income, that's based on a GDP of $4 trillion in 1980. Okay? Now, when you say the top 1% shifted from 10.7 to 20.2%, now it's doubled, that's doubling on a GDP of $18 trillion in 2014. In other words, it's even more in absolute terms. You know, 10.7 of 7% of a $4 trillion GDP, you know, is far above $400 billion, whatever you want to say. You know, these are rough estimates here. You know, 20% of 18 trillion is about 9 trillion. Okay, 20% of 18 trillion, no, not 9 trillion, excuse me, right? 20% is about 4 trillion, excuse me, about $4 trillion compared to $400 billion. So in absolute terms, the 1% goes from $400 billion in 1980 to $4 trillion in 2014. Okay, so you got to, you know, the magnitude, not just the percentage, but the absolute level of income, national income, accruing to the wealthiest 1%. It's obscene, you know, really obscene. And it's only the beginning because Trump is proposing another $6.2 trillion tax cuts. And that's not counting, you know, the revisiting of this repatriation, corporate profits repatriation that was, you know, first phase was under George Bush, as I said, 2005. Bring back your $900 trillion U.S. multinationals that you're hoarding offshore and not paying taxes. Bring them back, and instead of paying 35% tax, you pay 5.25% tax. That was 2005. Well, now the bill pending in Congress is bring back your $2.5 trillion, which is probably a lowball estimate of what's being hoarded offshore, and you only have to pay 10%, right? Do it again. Well, what was the response to the first time by the multinationals? Well, gee, this is a pretty good deal. Let's just keep everything else we make offshore, you know, and get a second bite of the apple later, which is what they're doing right now. I mean, you keep giving these deals to them, it's just an incentive for them to keep doing it, right? And, you know, this $6.2 trillion being proposed by Trump and the Republicans is not just non-inclusive of this repatriation, right? Repatriation is more tax cut, right? That's like, you know, if you're going to go from 35% to 10% on $2 trillion, let's say, right, you're giving them a 15% tax cut to bring that money back, right? So somewhere around $400 or $500 billion they get to keep further. And, of course, the $6.2 trillion Trump tax cuts coming do not include, as well, the reversal of all these tax loophole ripoffs with corporate inversions. In other words, corporations moving their headquarters on paper to somewhere in Europe and then not paying taxes in the U.S. You know, that's in addition. We don't know how many hundreds of billions that is. So $6.2 trillion, you know, is the lowball end of this thing. Well, no wonder they get to increase their take from 10% to 20%. And it's going to rise, right? By the way, in terms of income, the bottom 20%, 30 million households in this country, right, only earned 4% of the national income, and that's been pretty much steady since 1980, right? So it's really the middle class That's been going back rapidly from this, 19.9 to 12.5. Okay, that's enough of numbers, huh? You get the point. But, even the bottom 20% of households are going to take a whack here, Labor secretary just appointed by Trump, Andrew Putzer. I'm going to call him Putzer, right? We're going to get putzed here, right? Comes from a fast food company. Guess what he's going to do to minimum wage? you think you're getting minimum wage increases out of Republican Congress and Putzer? No way. That's the end of minimum wages, federal minimum wages. Some states will have to move forward on their own, which they will. But don't expect federal government to do anything. And, this guy Putzer has been on record here. He doesn't like paid sick leave either. He thinks that's a terrible thing, paid sick leave, and so you're not going to see any improvement there. And you're going to see a reversal of the recently passed overtime rule. Under George Bush, what the government did was say that a whole millions of people, 6 million of them, weren't hourly wage workers; they're salary workers. Just simply said they weren't professionals; they're salary. They didn't have to get paid overtime. So they wiped out, millions of people from being eligible for time and a half, double time, overtime, if they were hourly paid. In my book, The War at Home, I estimated that was about the $30 to $40 billion a year savings for corporations. Right. So that overtime rule was restored here in recent years. But now that was restored by executive order, and goodbye to that one, too, right? So the low-paid are going to take it in the ear in new ways, while the middle class keeps getting screwed and the 1% keeps raking in the dough. Okay, and another indicator of interest here, productivity. And unit labor costs in the U.S. Unit labor costs for companies is a function of productivity and wages. Well, wages aren't rising, but productivity is collapsing in the U.S. because there hasn't been enough real investment. And if productivity collapses, unit labor costs rise. But instead of doing something about productivity through investment, what companies do is keep unit labor costs down by squeezing more out of wages. Because, labor costs are productivity and or wages, right? And if you don't do anything about productivity, you want to keep your costs down, you attack wages some more, and that's coming. Productivity in the 1950s in this country was rising about 3.5% per year. You know what it's been under in the last decade? 0.5%. And now it's actually turned negative. So productivity is collapsing, and that will cause even more focus by companies on wage compression across the board, not just for the poor, right? And what about all this infrastructure and this free trade? He's going to bring jobs back. Trump's running around. He talks about Carrier Corporation. He talks about Ford and, a few others here. That's just to keep in front of people that he's doing something about it. He's not going to do anything about that. I recently wrote an article, Taming Trump. Appeared on Counterpunch and Global Research. You can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Go read that. How they're going to tame Trump? They're already taming him. What I predict is what we got here is a false right populism going on. That's a mirror image, a parallel mirror image of the false left populism of Obama in 2008. They're fooling you again. Just as they did in 2008, no populism. 2016, same thing. The capitalists are manipulating these two parties, two wings of their one party, and they know people are getting upset, and there's a populist rebellion building. They know that, so they pick the politician who can manipulate that populism, that discontent. Obama did a great job in 2008. And now they picked Trump to do it again. It's just a mirror image. It's false. Nothing's going to come of this. Mine workers in Virginia, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania are going to still lose their jobs. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to be done for them. Right? And what about preventing jobs from going offshore because of free trade? You think anything's going to happen because of that? No. Look, Trump is a free trader. He just doesn't believe in multilateral free trade agreements. He believes in negotiating them bilaterally, one-on-one. And that's what he's going to do. And it's going to be free trade, but it's going to be one-on-one. But he's going to give himself cover with all these public statements, you know, about Carrier and Ford and so forth. And if you look deep into those deals, they're just subsidies to these corporations. They're just buying these corporations off. He's not telling them, thou shalt not do it, or else I'm going to slap this or that tax on you. No. He's providing more freebies to them to get the publicity right now, and he gets a little publicity and then, you know, for a year, and then Kerry and all those guys are going to do it again slowly anyway. And we're going to renegotiate bilateral deals, free trade deals. At the same time, we're going to give tax cuts to corporations to replace workers with more capital. You know, if you look at how we've lost 7 million jobs in manufacturing since 2000, as much of those jobs have been lost because of replacement of capital, replacing workers with new equipment and capital, right? As has been lost because of free trade moving offshore, both of them. So Trump's going to give this false thing. He's going to do something about trade job loss, which he isn't. And at the same time, he's going to accelerate the loss for capital replacement through his tax bill. That's the reality of this so-called policy shift going on. Okay. Haven't left myself much time to talk about Italy and the referendum. As we know, earlier this week, Italian workers and middle-class folks and small business folks voted against the Renzi government's attempt to concentrate more power in its neoliberal hands. Why was he trying to do this? Well, because he had plans for infrastructure spending in particularly the south, southern part of Italy and Sicily, and he wanted to bypass negotiating with the locals on the terms and conditions of who would get the benefit from this European and northern Italian infrastructure investment that was being planned. He wanted to take power out of the hands of the locals. In other words, reduce democracy. You know, that's what neoliberalism does. Neoliberalism wants to concentrate their power politically among bureaucrats and technocrats and big corporations and their handpicked politicians. That's what neoliberalism on the political side is about. And that's what Renzi was trying to do, and the people voted it down by 60% or more, a huge vote against it. Well, what does this mean for Europe, for Italy, first of all? Well, it means Italy already in recession will be deeper in recession. Renzi resigned, of course, as he had promised he would do, which means they'll put a technocrat, the European Commission, and the Northern Europeans will ensure some sort of technocrat takeover like they did before in the other Italian crisis, 2012. You know, they put Mario Monti in there, who was just a bureaucrat from the European Commission, to run the show for a while. And they'll do that again. But more important implication is, what does this mean for the Italian banking system, which is really in trouble? All top six banks. How much trouble you can see by the collapse of their bank stocks, which are now going down further. At the lead of this collapse is Monte dei Paschi Bank, third largest in Italy, which is already bankrupt, technically. And they're trying to bail it out. And they were lining up private investors, you know, global hedge fund guys and so forth, to avoid a government having to bail out the banks there. And they're all connected. connected. You know, if the posse goes under, the rest are going to have to be bailed out. Well, now this private approach, get private investors, is all up in the air. You know, the Italian government's up in the air. This referendum did not pass. So these private investors are pulling out, saying, oh, well, you know, we're not going to bail it out. You know, also some investors from the Middle East there, Qatar and so forth. We got to see what happens here, which means they're going to have to now do a government bailout. And now the big debate's going to be how they do this government bailout. Will the ECB, European Central Bank, have to play a role here coming in and directly bailing out? It's got funds to do that, but it will impose more austerity, for sure, on the Italians, which means they're real economy will go deeper in recession. You know, it's like the early stages of Greece writ large, you might say, the Greece debt crisis, you know. Same thing, moving down the same road here with Italy. At a time when European banks in general are already shaky. And that brings us to our next topic and why the European Central Bank has decided to continue QE. You know, this past week, they also made a decision on continuing quantitative easing, i.e. this monetary policy of pumping liquidity, free money, into the banking system. They've got to continue it because the European banks, you know, are in the doghouse. They're having real trouble. And now you got money capital flowing out of Europe to the U.S., which isn't good either, you know, just as the ECB pumps money into it, you know, into the banking system, it flows right out, you know, to the U.S. and elsewhere. So it can't stop. What it decided to do was to continue QE through the rest of 2017, an extra 3 months. You know, it was supposed to October 1st, I believe, it was supposed to end QE, which they pumped, 80-some billion dollars a month into the European economy by buying bonds. Problem is the ECB bond buying, QE bond buying program was buying mostly bonds of those countries that didn't need to have the bonds bought as much. You know, the periphery Eurozone countries needed it the most, but they weren't buying their bonds. They were buying German bonds. So it's just a way of, you know, subsidizing a sector of the Eurozone that didn't really need it. And there wasn't enough government bonds anyway to buy, so they started buying corporate bonds. You know, this is, you know, guaranteed sale for the private sector. Now, Japan's already doing that, and they've gone even further. They're buying stocks over there. That's how desperate they are. I mean, you run out of corporate bonds, so, you know, government bonds, so you got to buy something else if you want to keep pumping money into the economy. So that's what they've been doing, and they're continuing to do that. They've reduced the rate from 80-some billion dollars a month to 60 billion, but they extended it 3 months. So, you know, net on net, it's an increase in QE, you know, because it's going to go another 3 months. That's another $250 billion for the last 3 months of 2017. And even though they've cut it by $20 billion here, $60-some billion, you know, that's about $200 billion, and they've cut it by $20 billion over the next 6 months. So, you know, they're reducing from 80-some to 60-some is like a $120 billion reduction of injection, but you got a $200 billion continuation in the last 3 months, so that's like, $80 billion more over 2017. It's an increase in QE, you know. But it's not having much effect on the stock markets. It's played out. You know, the effect of monetary policy on stock and bond markets is played out. You know, it's gone that route. The problem in Europe is they don't want to, the bankers and capitalists, particularly the Germans who run the show over there, don't want fiscal infrastructure spending, right? But now we're getting it in the U.S., and it's causing a imbalance between the U.S. The monetary policy differences are an imbalance, rates going up in the U.S., down in Europe, and fiscal spending and tax cuts in the U.S., not in Europe, imbalance and money capital flowing out of Europe, that will slow it down even. and further. Now, not just Europe in trouble, and Europe banks in trouble, getting worse now with the Italian referendum. And as I've said before, it's going to get worse when we have elections next year in France. Now, I still predict that the National Front will win there and bar the door when that happens. Okay, so what about China here? I said we'd say something about China, right? Well, the rising dollar and interest rates is putting big pressure on China because it's slowing economy already has caused a decline in its currency and has required the Chinese central bank to intervene and pump up the economy with massive liquidity injections over there too, right? And to use its foreign exchange reserves, China using its, you know, dollars and pounds and so forth, to buy its currency to keep it from falling further. You see, it's pegged in a range to the U.S. dollar, which means, you know, all this talk about China currency manipulations is just bullshit on the part of Trump and these others. China is not manipulating its currency. It's doing everything to prevent the decline of its currency. It's spending hundreds of billions. Last year, spent $500 billion to keep its currency and capital flight, which is related, under control. You know, they're doing everything they can to prevent volatility in the currency in relationship to the dollar, and it's going to devalue it nonetheless. They can't stop it. You know, but these are market forces. In other words, market forces driven by the U.S. policies, by the way, raising interest rates in the dollar, you know, this is causing the devaluation of the Chinese currency. And they've been trying to prevent it, you know, entering into the marketplace, buying up their currency and so forth. But nonetheless, it's at the low end. It can't stop. It's almost at 7% or 7 to the dollar here, and it's going to break through that floor, and it's going to decline. And when that happens, you're going to see even more pressure on capital flight out of China. Again, why does anyone want to hold onto a currency that's collapsing, falling in value? No, they get out of it. They sell it, right? They sell it, which causes it to decline even more, and they get into another currency, which causes that other currency, the dollar, to rise even more, and that's going on all over the emerging markets and in Europe. They're buying dollars, selling their currency and buying dollars, investors, which drives the value of the dollar up even more, okay, and causes capital flight. In other words, if I'm a Chinese investor, I don't want to hold Chinese securities and currencies. You know, I'm going to sell them because they're falling in value. I'm going to buy something that's rising in value. Well, China's trying to stop that, but not having that much luck. In the meantime, it's come out that China's banks are hiding $2 trillion in bad loans. $2 trillion. So we'll see what happens to the banking system in China. Another weak link in the global capitalist economy. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus. We'll be talking about the U.S. Fed, Federal Reserve's rate rise next week and what it means. This is Alternative Vision. Jack Rasmus.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bhavani, and I'm the host of I Eat Green with Bhavani every Thursday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.